risk-free and always cost-free trial.
Did you know that KBOO podcasts all our news and talk shows?
You can find the podcast on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Just search for your favorite show and hit subscribe to get all the latest episodes downloaded to your favorite device.
Or search for KBOO on iTunes, Google Play to get all the KBOO podcasts.
It's just shy of 11 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the food show. Today, talking with Liz Carlisle, the author of Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. Please remember, listeners, that KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved by becoming a member. We'd love that if you made a tax-deductible contribution before the end of the year to community radio here. KBOO.FM is the way to get there. KBOO.FM, and make a contribution to your favorite community radio station. That would be great. Stay tuned for the food show.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. As we hit the end of the year, I'll be returning to some past guests on the food show. Later in the hour, I'll be playing a story told by fermentation enthusiast Sander Katz about a trip he took to Indonesia where he witnessed tempeh being made the traditional way. But first, I recently checked back in with Liz Carlisle, author of the book Lentil Underground. You can find my interview with Liz from a couple years back on the KBOO website. In our recent conversation, Liz and I were joined by Tavia Gilbert, who is, among other things, an award-winning audiobook narrator. Tavia talked about her relationship with the book and read a passage. Here is that conversation.
I'm Liz Carlisle. I'm the author of Lentil Underground, and I teach in the School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences at Stanford University.
My name is Tavia Gilbert, and I am the narrator of the Lentil Underground. I work primarily as an audiobook narrator, but I'm also a publisher, producer, writer, visual artist, and a number of other things. And really happy to be here.
Listeners can go back to the archive and hear our interview when Lentil Underground first came out, but could you give us a quick overview of the book?
Yeah. So this is the story of the sustainable agriculture movement in my home state of Montana, and kind of a microcosm of, I think, this challenge that we're facing in our food system in this country to try to move towards more environmental sustainability, as well as, you know, save many family farms that are really on the brink of bankruptcy and boost rural economic development at the same time as we're trying to solve these health problems and these environmental problems in our food system.
In your research and writing, what did you find most illuminating, or what did you kind of come across that was the most interesting?
I think what was really interesting to me about this story is I was researching this book in rural Montana and rural eastern Montana, which is the state I grew up in, but it's not the part of the state I grew up in. I grew up in a college town, Missoula, on the western half of the state. And I think I had always thought about food system activism as really sort of originating from consumers who were concerned about the carbon footprint of their diet and the health of their diet. And I was really amazed by the extent to which farmers themselves, even farmers who were working within limited incomes and really difficult circumstances, were working really hard to make our food system more sustainable and had been doing so for decades, that there were these organized networks of farmers who were working with each other to try to figure out, how do we get off synthetic fertilizer? How do we stop using pesticide? Can we grow healthy food for consumers and also improve our bottom line so that we can pass this land on to our kids? So that's why I was really passionate about writing this book, is so that people could understand that, wow, you know, farmers are working on these problems and we should all really support them.
And Tavia, before we talk about the process of making an audiobook version of Lintel Underground, what was your response to reading the book?
You know, I was the people who cast me for books know me very well, and they know what my heart and soul respond to. So when I was offered this book, I was very moved by the idea of it. When I was a young acting student, I created for my senior thesis project an original drama, a nonfiction fiction about the effects of corporate farming on family farms. And I did about 3 years of research into genetically modified foods and family farms in America, how they've changed over the years, how they've been impacted by corporate farming. So I was absolutely delighted to be offered this book because it was a subject that is so close to my heart. Almost 20, you know, not quite 20 years after graduation from college, it's still a subject that I follow closely and think it gets to the very heart of the American dream, the American ideal of self-determination and self-reliance. And really, food security is democracy. So I was riveted by the subject matter and totally invested in the book in a very emotional, very personal way.
So it's been about 2.5 years since the book came out. Has anything been added or changed since the initial writing of the book?
You know, it's been remarkably consistent from hardcover to paperback. Certainly lots of things were worked on in the drafting process at the end. We tried really hard to get the hardcover right. But, you know, the audiobook is a whole different kettle of fish.
Well, and can you explain how is the audiobook different?
The work of an audiobook narrator is to be a medium for the writer, to translate into an audio performance what the writer put on the page. Both mediums, print and audio, are very intimate, of course, and nothing can replace the printed word, nor should it. But an audio experience of a story, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, is a deeply intimate exercise. The storyteller is talking directly into the listener's ear. It's I just ran into an audiobook narrator who I adore and told her Friday, every time I hear her voice, it's like imprinting, like those, I think, geese imprint. That's the feeling. There's a relationship that's created between the storyteller and the listener. So taking a piece of nonfiction, which is just as passionate, just as emotionally evocative as a piece of fiction, and performing it, offers just one more opportunity to reach an audience in a very intimate way. And I love that this was put into audio because this is not just about, it's not just a nonfiction story about lentils. It's human beings being self-determined, self-actualized, combining forces to be mutually independent and interdependent. So it's a really passionate story that I think is perfectly suited to the audio art form.
Well, I want to kind of get to the heart of what you're kind of accomplishing with this book. You talk about the people that are involved. This is a very stories-focused book. And I want to kind of ask you why. So when it comes to complex social and environmental issues, like the challenges that face our food system, why write about the stories of particular people?
Well, I think that everybody, you know, my readers, are people who live at the scale of a human life. We all experience the drama of our own lives, of trying to make meaning in our lives, of figuring out what it is we want to do in the short time we're on this planet. And when I talk to people about those kinds of deep questions, it seems like many people have kind of similar themes that emerge. We want to leave things better for our communities, for the world. We want to pass something better on to our children. We want to have some kind of a positive impact on the people around us. And I feel like that was really what was at the center of the story of these farmers, particularly David Oyen in central Montana, who were trying to move to an organic food system.
that it was really about trying to leave the world better for the next generation, trying to contribute something to their community and really make meaning out of their lives on this planet and understand our place as humans, really understand the human condition. So I wanted to write about it in that way because sometimes I think complex issues like the food system, like the environmental issues we face, can feel really abstract or they can feel kind of beyond our reach. And I think the story and the people's lives who are involved in trying to accomplish these things really bring it home in a way that people can relate to, whether it's to sort of understand that they're on an analogous journey or maybe they're on a similar journey. There's something there that, as Tevia was saying, is very intimate and very passionate, and that's really what I wanted to share.
I'm also wondering, you know, as somebody who's lived on one of the coasts for a number of years, to be able to like understand what's going on in the middle of the country, it helps to have a person that we can look to see their experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I hope that this book is sort of a cross-cultural vehicle for people in farm country and people on the coast, or maybe people around the world. The book was translated into Japanese, and I've gotten emails from people in other places, too, to try to understand each other in these human terms and understand the things that we do have in common, and that really people, of course, do want to move towards this shared prosperity for our future, even though, you know, of course, we hear all these news stories about, you know, the debates that we're in and the conflict that we're in and the political divides that we have. There is this common desire to leave the world better for our children. And I think that if we can have more dialogue based on that, that we can make more progress in really getting there.
So I've had the good fortune to meet and work with Tevia and witness her bring a piece of text to life. And so, Liz, I'm just curious, what is it that Tevia brings to enhance Lintel Underground?
Oh gosh, it's just amazing. I mean, so she's the best in the business. She probably won't tell you this herself, but she won the award this year, 2017, the Audi Award for the best female narrator of audiobooks. And what she brings is this understanding of how to perform a story. When I first heard clips of her reading Lintel Underground, I felt like I'd gone to Lintel Underground, the Broadway production, and I was hearing the soundtrack of that. And, you know, as a person who loves that art form as well, who loves theater, film, I understand what's different about that than reading a book. I mean, they're both wonderful, potentially transformative experiences, but they're different. And I've always had this dream that somebody might be able to actually drive across Montana while listening to this story. And so I think she's made that come true for me as well. That obviously when people listen to audio, they can be in a number of different settings, and that can be really powerful as well. And it's just, it's a whole new audience that this story can access. There are now lots of people who listen to audiobooks rather than read, or who do it in addition to reading. And I just think it's wonderful to transfer into this new medium because of this wonderful actress who took this on. So it's been fun for me. I feel like I've seen the story in a whole new light, too.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. I'm talking with Liz Carlisle and Tevia Gilbert, who have recently released the audiobook for Lintel Underground. I asked Tevia to read a passage from the book for us. Liz sets it up.
This is the passage in the book that talks about what this story means in human terms and really why community and this recognition of interdependence is at the center of not only fixing our food system, but I think addressing all these really critical environmental challenges and social challenges that are top of mind for a lot of people right now, I think, at this moment in human history.
Great. I'll read it's a fairly short section. Just about a page long. And the section is headed, "You Can't Do It Alone," which is a great way to set off what the thrust of the book is. "Much like a newly initiated legume farmer, I want to think that lentils are a straightforward substitute for synthetic fertilizer, a cheaper, more environmentally benign alternative. To some extent, this is true. But if that was really all there was to it, there would be no lentil underground, just a smattering of savvy growers rationally applying plant-based nitrogen instead of expensive ammonium nitrate. But the fact is that biological fertility is more than just a different nutrient management approach. It's an entirely different way of life, one in which time and space broaden considerably, and the illusion of control falls apart. Building your soil biologically is not a precise prescription for a particular crop, but a contribution to a larger ecology, subject to independent variables, geologic time, and global biogeochemical cycles. You will not capture all the value on this farm in this year. You cannot individualize your return. To build biological fertility is to build community, to accept interdependence with other creatures and foster a common benefit. This way of life cultivates a new kind of awareness, a new empathy. You have to pay attention beyond this homestead. You have to pay attention beyond this season. You cannot spray and then forget about it and go to the lake. Planting organic lentils and all the other crops that go with them becomes part of who you are, what you are conscious of, how you see the world. It forces you to listen more deeply, more expansively, and it softens, to some extent, the borders of the self. This is the great irony of the lentil underground, or perhaps its secret. What rugged individualism brought together, only community can sustain. I love that section. That's such a great, like the perfect section to pull from the book, because it really is this beautiful piece of writing about how it's not just what we're putting in the earth or our yields or the ratio of fertilizer to growing days. It is about community. It is about being responsive to one's home, which is the earth on which we live, the families in which we farm, the communities in which we partner. It's really such a beautiful analogy for, I think, a way of life that is not dying, but is really fighting to be sustained and acknowledged. It's not all black and white data. We are living creatures in relationship with one another and with our planet. So I love this book.
Well, and as somebody who's read the book, it is exciting to hear it kind of embodied in the way that you read it. And I know for our listeners and myself, we're hearing it via the phone, but I can only imagine how kind of powerful those words are made by, you know, your reading.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just transported listening to her perform that section. I just closed my eyes and experienced it. And I think it's amazing because I feel like she is bringing forth what is at the heart of these people's stories who I spoke to. It's almost like she knew them, just totally got it. And I think it's really powerful. I think about moments I've had at musical concerts because it feels very much like music when Tavia reads. And that feeling of just being transported by something that you can feel that inspires you to be some really important part of who you are as a human in some really fundamental way. So, yeah, I mean, what a great experience for me. I love it.
Those are really kind words. And one of the things that was so cool about being cast for this is that I do know these places. So I grew up in southern Idaho. My childhood was full of the landscape of Idaho and Wyoming and Montana. And so when Liz is writing about these places, these are places I know. I spent a lot of time in Bozeman and Missoula, and it's meaningful to, I can always dive into any book that I'm narrating and make it personal, but when it already is personal, it's like I get to luxuriate in that story even more than I would otherwise.
What do you think is something new that someone who has read the book would glean from the experience of listening to it?
I think there's a sense with nonfiction often that nonfiction is dry. And when you have a writer like Liz, it's obviously a passionate book. But I do think that people have a certain preconceived idea of the emotional nature of a book of nonfiction. And I think that I am very emotionally available to my reads, and that's the great narrators are always emotionally available and emotionally evocative in their read. But I think that that might be a new layer a listener might have even more present in their experience with the book, that the passion driving Liz to devote herself to this study and research and relationship building for years, the relationship and passion of the farmers, I think that really comes through in an audio performance.
My experience of it, in addition to that, is that you can visualize more freely. When I'm listening to Tavia read, my vision and my visual imagination doesn't have to focus on words on a page, and it's totally available for me to then visualize everything that she's reading to me. And I found that quite powerful. It's more cinematic.
We're about out of time. But I'm curious, how can people find the audiobook version of Lintel Underground?
It's a Cantor audiobook. So if you were to Google, honestly, if you were to Google Lintel Underground audiobook, you would find it. But you would find it on the Cantor audiobook webpage.
And you can also go to audible.com, which has that available for download, or I believe it would be available at any of the streaming services, downpour.com, audiobooks.com, and through the library streaming services like Overdrive or OneClick. Those are also great places to find audiobooks.
Great. Liz, thank you for coming back on the show. And Tavia, thank you so much for joining us and for a wonderful performance. It was a privilege to get to hear that read.
Oh, it's so great to be here with you. Thanks for having me. Liz, thank you so much for this book. Really, it was such a delight to get to do.
Well, really, my pleasure and my honor. Thank you, of course, so much, Tavia, for reading and performing this book. And Chris, thanks so much for the conversation.
That was Liz Carlisle and Tavia Gilbert talking about the audiobook of Lintel Underground. You're listening to The Fujo on KBOO Community Radio. Up next, I'm going to play a story from the Food Show archives. A few years back, I had the opportunity to interview Sandor Katz before the annual Fermentation Festival. He told me a story about a trip he took to Indonesia. He witnessed tempeh being made in a regional process, and it got him thinking about the difference between industrial and traditional food production. Here's that story from Sandor Katz.
So tempeh is a style of fermenting soybeans where you basically use molds that digest the soybeans and also bind them together into a mat that's typically sliced up and fried, and it comes from the Indonesian island of Java.
Hello?
Tempeh has been available in the United States since the 70s, and it's really easy to trace exactly how tempeh became popular in the U.S. and it was subcultures, and specifically from a community in Tennessee called The Farm, which was sort of trying to have a basically soy-based vegan diet, but they recognized that they couldn't just eat soybeans even though they were so protein rich, so they started investigating different traditional ways of preparing soybeans, and they learned about tempeh from food scientists at Cornell, as I understand it, and they obtained a sample of a starter for tempeh that was a pure culture starter of a mold called Rhizopus oligosporus that actually the USDA maintains a culture collection, and they basically obtained a sample of the strain of Rhizopus oligosporus that's in the USDA's culture collection, and it's called Var Saito. And Saito is a Japanese microbiologist who, I guess, is the first microbiologist who really investigated tempeh and, out of the tempeh sort of picked that particular strain out as the sort of active principle of the tempeh. And in microbiology, this has really been, the approach to fermentation is sort of, look at these, undefined, groups of organisms that are found on different traditional foods, and really pick out the essential organisms, out of that, to get rid of everything that's extraneous. Because the bias in microbiology is that, in general, microorganisms are, dangerous, and, we should just figure out what the specifically functional ones are and get rid of all the other ones. So, in a laboratory under sterile conditions, it's pretty easy to propagate a pure strain fungus. But in a home kitchen, it's extremely challenging, and I would say it's the most challenging thing that I've ever done in the realm of fermentation, is trying to propagate pure culture Rhizopus oligosporus. And I've done it a few times, but with limited success. But I was amazed when I went to Indonesia and visited a village where they produce tempeh, to see what the source of the culture was. And it basically, this guy pulled down a shoebox filled with these moldy leaves of a particular tree. They call it the waru tree. It's a hibiscus family tree. And basically, each time they make tempeh, they take a few of the beans out and place maybe a half dozen beans between two leaves of this tree that's right outside their compound, and then over-ripen it. So when they peel the leaves apart, it's a whole mycelial mat, but it's also sort of turned a dark color, the color of sporulation of that particular mold, or though it's actually a couple of colors. There's like tan ones that are indicative of Aspergillus molds, along with black ones that are indicative of Rhizopus molds. So they're working with a mixed community that evidently has the ability to perpetuate itself pretty easily. So basically, the way that they made tempeh is, they had dehulled the beans and split them and cooked them, and then laid them out on this big table to dry. And their batch was basically a 50 kilo bag of soybeans. So it's like 100 pounds of dry soybeans that they had dehulled and split and cooked, and they were drying it and cooling it. And once you get rid of most of the surface moisture and you get it down to body temperature, then it's time to introduce the culture. And the way they did that is, this guy took one leaf in each of his hands and then just sort of, dug into the soybeans, lifted up a handful, and moved his hands against each other, basically to rub these leaves against the surfaces of lots of beans. And then he just like pick up another handful and rub them and just try to get different portions of this big pile of soybeans. And then at the end, once he felt they were adequately cultured, before putting it all in, the bags that serve as the forms for the blocks of tempeh, he perpetuated it by taking a few of the beans and putting it between some leaves and doing maybe a half a dozen set of leaves like that to perpetuate it. But I just loved the simplicity of how, in their little, sort of low-tech village operation, they were able to perpetuate it, in contrast to, the extraordinary sterilization methods that are required for perpetuating sort of the single strain that we're mostly working with in the U.S. And to me, it was just, a story of how, sort of the science of microbiology, with its biases against these broad, undefined communities of organisms, which are really what all traditional fermentations are based on, in an effort to improve on the cultures, they've actually, disempowered people and made it something that it's impossible for, the casual generalist to propagate.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the KBU Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived on the KBU website at kbu.fm. I want to thank our guests, Liz Carlisle, Tavia Gilbert, and Sandra Katz, for being on today's show. I also want to thank WMPG, Southern Maine Community Radio, for letting me use their studios to record the interview with Liz and Tavia. Next up, we're going to hear from dietitian Melinda Himmelgarn on Food Sleuth Radio. Her guest is Michael Carolyn, professor of sociology at Colorado State University and author of No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise. And stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives at Noon. Don't forget to tune in again next month on the third Wednesday of January for another episode of The Food Show. Until next time, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Himmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today, I am honored and delighted to welcome my guest. He's been on the show before and he's back, Dr. Michael Carolyn. He is a professor of sociology and the Associate Dean for Research for the College of Liberal Arts at Colorado State University. He is the author of The Real Cost of Cheap Food, The Sociology of Food and Agriculture, Reclaiming Food Security and Cheaponomics, The High Cost of Low Prices, among other books. He is also co-editor for the Journal of Rural Studies, and he has published more than 150 peer-reviewed articles and chapters. I am sitting here with his latest book, which is a real treasure. The title is No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise. Welcome, Dr. Carolyn. It is a pleasure to have you back with me.
Thanks, Melinda. It's nice to be back, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, I have to ask you first and foremost, what led to your writing this book?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think there's two pieces to that, if I were to reflect back on why I read it. One is, I've seen a lot of books out there that deal with food, and I know the food market for books is really quite populated, but often one model is to focus on one commodity, and even those that try to take a more holistic approach, I've never really felt like it really accurately depicted the food system, or a term that I refer to as foodscape, which I'm sure we'll probably talk about later in this conversation. And so I wanted to paint that larger picture, specifically kind of pushing against sometimes the image of a food system or foodscape that's reduced to a commodity chain or a value chain where it starts with farmers and goes with producers. And I wanted to emphasize the point that there's so many other people out there that populate our food worlds, which is kind of part of the reason why I called it No One Eats Alone. It's to play on this idea that there's so many people that are part of our food worlds. And so that can go from not only who we typically think of, which are farmers, retailers, and consumers, but people such as the individual I interviewed in China who was heading a vitamin manufacturing plant that's responsible for producing all of the industrialized vitamin C, or most of the industrialized vitamin C in the world that goes into fortifying our foods, to the gentleman who showed me what looked like a paint deck where you could order the flesh of your salmon based upon the type of feed that this gentleman could feed the salmon. So it's a order your color salmon scenario. And there's all these stories out there about all these curious ways in which we engage with in unusual ways our food. And I wanted to be able to tell those stories. And I also wanted to inject a bit of my knowledge as a social scientist into talking about things like behavioral change and community and conviviality and stuff like that that's important to me as a professional and practicing sociologist.
Mm-hmm. It's so refreshing to hear from a sociologist's perspective, because I think so often, and you talk about dietitians in the book, and we don't need more nutrition education. I think most of us understand what we should be eating largely, but there are all of these other pieces and players in the way. And I love the way you hone in on those as only a sociologist can. I want to ask you, though, I was totally entertained by this book, but who did you write this book for?
Well, I usually start by writing my books for my students, because a lot of the impetus behind my books are my students just are such a source of wonderful questions, and they look to their instructors as the experts, and we're not. And so this is kind of a culmination in some respects of questions that students And in more general terms, just the public have asked me as I travel around and interview people and give talks and talk to people. And so it's spurred on by some of those questions that intrigued me. And in wanting to answer them myself, I guess in some sense I'm responding to all these other questions that I've encountered over the years that I wasn't really able to answer when I was first presented with it. And I can't claim to say I have anywhere near all the answers at all, but this is a learning process in food, which is why food is such an interesting topic for scholarship, and that it touches on everything, and everybody has a connection to food. Everyone's in some ways an expert on food because we're so intimately familiar with it that it's just one of those amazing topics that it's fun to discuss and to talk about with others because everybody has an opinion and everybody has an experience with food, and it makes it very meaningful to have these conversations because we're so closely connected to it.
Exactly. Well, I want to start on page one of this book, the introduction, and you write, "Every meal, whether enjoyed around the family dinner table or scarfed down over a keyboard, is connected to a multitude of people." The question that I struggle with is, how do we get eaters to care about the multitude of people that are connected to their food? It's easier not to know in many cases.
Yeah, so I kind of take issue with some of the, well, it might sound as if I'm hostile to nutritional literacy campaigns. I'm certainly not. But I do point out that I don't know of anyone that doesn't know that eating a Twinkie or deep fat fried cheese curds are bad for you. And yet we all still have those moments where we consume foods like that, and often we consume those types of foods at levels that have negative health effects. And yet we know that they're bad for us. And so I do try to unpack that question of, if it's not just about knowledge deficiencies, what is it? And I try to tell it's a somewhat elaborate story and a layered story, because there isn't, unfortunately, a one-size-fits-all answer to that. And I know we have a tendency in our culture for one-size-fits-all answers, which are, you know, one one-size-fits-all answer. It has been kind of nutritional literacy campaigns. Let's just teach people about what foods are healthy and what foods are not. And I think part of the attraction to that solution is that it's apolitical, right? It's safe to say, rather than taking on big food or big ag, just saying, well, people need to be smarter so they can make better choices as consumers and yada, yada, yada. But I think it's important to talk about some of the power imbalances that exist in our food worlds. I think it's important to talk about the convivial nature and the role that that plays in our food. I get in conversations with economists often, and yes, price is important, but there's certainly far more than just economic reasons for why we do what we do and eat what we do. And I just want to give one example that I don't actually interrogate in the book, but it's one that I think about frequently, and that deals with the craft beer phenomenon. I think that so nicely illustrates the conviviality that it motivates and animates why we drink and eat what we do. And so if you look at the craft beer phenomenon during the recession, craft beer was one of the few things where consumption of it actually increased. And it's one of these strange things. I've had so many conversations with farmers at farmers markets who can't understand why an individual would complain about spending $5, for example, for a dozen organic free-range eggs, for instance, and yet that night go and spend willingly $6 or $7 or $8 on a pint of beer, which they will consume in 15 or 20 minutes.
Right.
And I think part of that does really lie upon some of these non-economic reasons for doing what we do. And I do know that the data show, when it comes to craft beer, that craft beer drinkers are far more likely to drink with others. If you drink alone, statistically speaking, you're more likely to drink a macro brew. And so I think there are things that we don't fully appreciate and understand when it comes to looking at some of those non-economic motivators that animate our buying and consumption and eating habits.
Right. Well, the idea of getting people to care about individuals in the food chain who are invisible, you know, I'm thinking specifically of our sentiment that we hear about migrant farm workers, for example. I remember talking to another sociologist, you probably know him, Jose Garcia, who used to at the University of Missouri. And he, I'll never forget, he said, you know, it's like we've got a big sign at the border. It says keep out and welcome at the same time. So we're dependent on individuals to produce our food, and yet we don't treat them very well. And just being aware of the plight of a farm worker in our food choices, I think is important, but it's easier not to know some of the pain and angst that exist in our food system. Would you agree?
Oh, I would agree completely. That's actually, I don't even know where to begin, Melinda, with that comment, because you've touched on a number of points that are important to me professionally and personally, and also they're important as part of a narrative or a thread that goes through that book. And part of the reason why I talk about no one eats, use that phrase, no one eats alone, you know, just to take a step back and then move back into the food system, I've been really struck the last 12 months with the presidential elections and after the presidential elections and looking at some of the data that talk about our relationship with what we would refer to in the social sciences as the others, those the people that are different from us, that look and think different from us. And this notion that the society has become increasingly polarized certainly does seem to bear out when you look at some of the data that come out of the recent elections. I know in 97 we had roughly, well, I think exactly, if I remember right, 164 competitive districts in the House. And that number has since been reduced to only 72 districts. And I know a lot of people chalk that up to gerrymandering, that idea that incumbents can redraw the lines in their districts to favor the incumbent, but there has been a number of studies that have looked at that and have actually indicated that gerrymandering only explains a fraction of those competitive districts going away. What explains the majority of it is a phenomena that's being referred to as geographic sorting, and this idea that where we've been moving as a society over the last 10 or 15 years in the communities, in the neighborhoods, where people are like us in terms of how we look, in terms of how we think, our communities are becoming more homogenous. And so I think this creates a strange polarizing effect where we live in these echo chambers where we're talking with individuals that think like ourselves, and we're not really having an opportunity as much as we maybe used to interact with people that are different from us. And so to bring this back to food, one of the things I talk about in this book that I have found really interesting when I look at some of these alternative food networks, local food, farmers markets, CSAs, producer and consumer co-ops, one thing that's really interesting that really hasn't been discussed is that these are also spaces where people that are different, if they're done right, if they're done intentionally, where people from different socioeconomic, different religious, different ethnic backgrounds have a chance to interact with each other, and the effects of that are actually really quite phenomenal and surprising in terms of reducing some of that social distance and enhancing empathy that we feel toward people from a different background. And I've actually been able to demonstrate with one study that I discuss in the book, where I look at people where they entered into some of these spaces for the first time, farmers markets and community-supported agriculture schemes, and I interviewed them and talked to them, and then 2 years later, I interviewed and talked to them again, and I was actually able to do a longitudinal study to try to understand how, in part, these spaces, these encounters in these spaces, shaped how people thought about food and thought about people within their food worlds. And there's evidence that suggests that by creating opportunities to interact with people that are different from ourselves, that they actually engender a degree of empathy, which is something I think we were really lacking in society. And I think that's kind of, we're seeing that viscerally play out in the Charlottesville's of the world and other things like that, that's becoming quite scary. And I think that's an element of some of these alternative food networks that don't get enough discussion. We talk about how they might create food access, create access to healthier foods, maybe how they might, from an economic development standpoint, afford communities certain things, but we really haven't discussed how they might, through engendering empathy, might actually improve social networks and the civicness of our society more generally.
I need to take one break and remind our listeners, if you're just joining us, you are tuned into Food Sleuth Radio, where we are joined by Dr. Michael Carolan. He is a professor of sociology and associate dean for research for the College of Liberal Arts at Colorado State University, and he is the author of the book we're talking about now, titled No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise. I am so glad, Dr. Carolan, that you mentioned the word empathy, because I feel personally and professionally that if I can leave the world better in one way, it would be to inject more empathy. And I love that, again, I'm still in the very beginning of your book, even though I've got the whole thing marked up with questions. But on page two, you ask the question, how can a food be healthy if it exploits people and the environment in the process of producing it? Exactly my sentiment. The question, though, is, it's very difficult for, I'm going to use the word consumer, even though I know that we need to shift from consumer to citizen eater, but for the citizen eater to identify the levels and amounts of exploitation in the food system, because it is largely hidden by design.
Yes. And so this is another kind of reason why I'm somewhat critical of things like focusing exclusively on things like nutritional literacy campaigns, because they focus on individual motivators and individual health. And I think that stuff's incredibly important. But if we don't also balance that with other messages and narratives and strategies that cause people, lead people to look outward, I think that's really a missed opportunity. And I talk about in the book, there's what's known as extrinsic and intrinsic values. And extrinsic values are those that pull us inward. They concern things like social status and self-advancement. And we know from studies that people with deeply held extrinsic values are more likely to obsess over things like financial success and status and fame. While intrinsic values, they lead us outward about finding kind of worth and reward through and with other individuals. And, you know, there's been a lot of research that talks about how advertisers and food corporations, they tend to support through their advertisements extrinsic values. When I give a lecture on this, I show an ad campaign from a thin pretzel company. Their ad line is, you can never be too thin, dump the old bag, and they're showing an old bag of pretzels in it. And so I want us to think about how we can engender practices that cause us to look not just within ourselves about what's good for us and what's good for our families, but also think about practices that cause us to look outward, to think about what's good for our community, and to think about health in ways that go beyond just individual health, but community health, or what might be referred to in some avenues as one health. And that's kind of why I talked about those alternative food networks in interesting ways, because if they're done right, they can actually elicit an outward-looking orientation to the world where we can start thinking about not what's just good for me, but what's good for us, what's good for the community. When we think about health, we also are therefore thinking about community health, environmental sustainability, social justice. And that's what I'm really hopeful when I look at some of these practices that are occurring around the world that I document in this book, because they are causing people to look outward and not just inward. And that's hopeful for me.
Getting back to that extrinsic value, you also gave the example of two school districts where in one, the children were exposed to Channel 1 advertising.
Right.
And in another community, they were not. And you showed that the children who were exposed to mass media through the Channel 1 network were much more likely to have extrinsic values rather than intrinsic ones. And I think that that is a big wake-up call for parents to recognize what mass media does in terms of driving this constant demand for more and more products, never really filling us up or making us feel satisfied for the things that we really need.
Yes. And the whole system is designed in some ways for that orientation, whether it's the advertisements or even just the idea of a consumer, which is why I push away against and kind of use the term foodscape, because I think the food system is become conflated with a value chain. And as I said, a value chain, it starts with farmers, it ends with consumers. But as I talk about in the book, we are so much more than consumers. And when you're only a consumer, there's only so many ways in which you can change the world. You know, as a consumer, the only way you can change the world is by shopping your way to social change. And I think there's more than that, and there has to be. I mentioned in the book there was an instance where I just walked into a 7-Eleven to see how many of their packaged snacks are manufactured by Pepsi-Cola. And, you know, Pepsi is one of the largest food manufacturers in the world. And I counted in this behind the back of the envelope study, 70% of the food there was manufactured by Pepsi. So my point is that, sure, you might be able to choose between, say, a GMO-free Saltinas tortilla chip or a MSG-free Doritos, but they're both owned by Pepsi. So does it really matter if what you're buying, if in the end you're still supporting the same conventional commodity chains and the same two or three major processors? And so we really need to think more as citizens, because once you think beyond the consumer, a whole world of levers and mechanisms opens up for real meaningful social change, and not the very narrow understanding of social change that kind of market-based democracies assume.
I worry personally about we have this illusion of choice. You describe it in the book as, you know, going down the supermarket aisle, similar to your 7-Eleven experience, and seeing, you know, how many gazillion brands of potato chips, when really they're controlled by very few farms and producers. So how do we restore true choice?
Right. Well, I don't want to diminish the importance of being intentional when you're in a grocery store in that sense, but I also want to make it really clear, and I have these conversations with my students, that you have to do more than just buy the quote-unquote right thing. I think it boils down to some degree, if you really want to change the foodscape or food system, you have to also think beyond just narrowly thinking about food and just get involved more broadly in civic life and in democratic politics more generally. Go out and go interact with somebody. Find a space where you can interact with somebody that looks and thinks different from yourself. Involve yourself in some of these alternative food networks like consumer cooperatives, or if you're a producer cooperatives, and try to increase their capacity and their resiliency. Because it's through some of these alternative networks, I think, where the most hope resides. And the more capacity that's built, it creates more opportunities for others to follow in our footsteps.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a really great idea for promoting a strong democracy. And I think many of us think that we are being better food citizens if we choose, say, local food. And I was intrigued, actually, by a statement that you have in the book. And you say, I'm no less critical of local food than I am of global commodity chains. Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, I get that a lot. I mean, I mentioned that. I mean, there's a couple reasons for saying that. One is more obvious. The more obvious response is, you know, local food, I can't see a value of local food in, say, the Phoenixes or Las Vegases of the world, where food really shouldn't be grown. And if he wanted to be a localvore in Las Vegas, I guess you'd be eating cactuses and lizards or something like that. So, I mean, at one extreme, local just doesn't really make sense to be able to sustain a population the size of Phoenix. You're going to have to rely upon medium to long commodity chains. There's also been a lot of research that looks at local food, and local food is a nice way of xenophobic people saying that we don't want to be able to support farmers in another continent as well. So there are some more kind of darker undertones to local food that scholars have been able to pull out, because it does have, in a few instances, attachments to xenophobia. But then also we have to realize that there's a lot of people all around the world, small shareholder peasant farmers, that have made the switch from their traditional commodities to cash commodities in order to sustain their livelihoods. And so they're a part of these large, long-distance commodity chains, too. And if we're going to cut those off, we have to think about what happens to them as well. So I want to make sure that consumers understand that in cutting off long commodity chains, it impacts the very people, I think, that we really think ought to be, that are already being rolled over when it comes to industrialized ag, too. And we have to be careful about what our actions do to them unintentionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that certainly we don't want to give up coffee in the Midwest or in, you know, North America. But I remember being in my grocery store in the summer, a Kroger chain, and seeing peppers in the produce aisle from Canada. And I thought, now there's an example of something that should fall under the category of insanity, because we certainly have plenty of peppers in the summer growing here in our environment. Why on earth would we be importing them from Canada?
Yeah, you can walk through aisles. I've had people ask, why do we have milk that comes from Arizona when we have enormous farms along here and the Front Range dairy farms as well? And that just kind of points to some very strange market inefficiencies, to put it very nicely, that exist due to policies, farm subsidies, and other investments that have been made that really distort what should be happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking about other concepts, and we just have a few minutes left, and it might not be fair for me to even bring this up, but I have to. And it has to do with biocultural diversity, lost agricultural and food knowledge, and the Green Revolution. And I wonder if you could give our listeners some food for thought about how we view the Green Revolution.
Wow, yeah, all right, a couple minutes. Well, let me approach your question this way. So I mentioned in the book, or interviewed an individual from Kensington outside of London. His name was Nick, I remember that. And he had spent a lifetime in the marketing business. And he mentions explicitly how in the 70s, one of his jobs was to nick from people their knowledge on how to cook. And I found that really striking, and we talked more about what he meant by nick, and he really literally meant nick as kind of a term to mean to kind of steal or take away. And that is something that's kind of happened with our industrial foodscape and how it has caused an eroding of knowledge in lots of ways. You see it all the time in agriculture, where we're losing the ability to farm without chemicals, using the intimate, important local knowledge to do say, pest integration management and other things to build up soil fertility. We're seeing a loss of knowledge when it comes to the eater end, in terms of, you know, who among us knows how to carve a turkey anymore? Who among us really knows how to select a ripe cantaloupe? We know we're supposed to hit it, but we don't really know how it's supposed to sound. And actually, in the book, I look back at some cookbooks from 100 years ago that talk about the color of the veins of a turkey neck should be if they're at their prime and things like
yes.
that. We've lost all of that visceral knowledge, and I think it's to the detriment of these alternative food networks. And we have to think about that knowledge. That knowledge has to come back if those alternative food networks are going to survive. We shouldn't expect people to pick fresh fruits and vegetables and prepare them if they don't know how to pick them and if they don't know how to prepare them. And so that knowledge piece is often neglected, too, when it comes to some of these things dealing with nutritional literacy.
Mm. Well, my multiple pages of questions will have to be put to rest, because I am going to have to say that our time is up. I will give you one chance to just leave our listeners with a charge.
Yeah, go talk to somebody and interact with somebody whom you never would have before, and who thinks and looks differently than you do, and start a conversation. And that's a good place to start as any.
Over a meal, I might add.
Over a meal. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank our listeners so much for joining us. And I want to remind everyone that Food Sleuth Radio is produced by Dan Hemmelgarn at KOPN Studios in beautiful downtown Columbia, Missouri. And I especially want to thank my guest, Dr. Michael Carolyn, Professor of Sociology and Associate Dean for Research for the College of Liberal Arts at Colorado State University, and the author of a terrific new book titled No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise. It is not a huge book, but it is packed with food for thought. Thank you so much, Dr. Carolyn, for this incredibly important book.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun.
And that's it for this food show. It's 11:58. Nick is here to bring you Jazz Lives in just a moment after a couple of announcements. Happy solstice every day, everybody. It's every day. Okay, let's have happy solstice every day. KBOO Portland.
Quick rundown for those who don't know what Astral Chavin is.
Jazz, soul, funk, rare grooves, breaks, beats, world music, hand-picked music.
Hosted by DJ Cecily.
Sunday nights
at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon.
KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. KBOO has inspired and supported communities for nearly 50 years. You were an important part of this work, and your gift to KBOO builds fiercely just, creative, and independent radio. Join your friends and neighbors in supporting KBOO in the Give Guide. It's easy and secure. Help us make our $18,000 goal before December 31st. Go to the giveguide.org website and find KBOO in the Creative Expression section. And as always, thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. It's time for Jazz Lives.